This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
It's me, but I'm not Patsy. I'm Bria, guest host at Joy on Paper, which is your radio show for everything involved with writing. Writers who dream of writing and who want to know the story behind the book. So, if you're wondering, Patsy has asked me to guest host and talk to a couple of science fiction authors today. I am very excited to have our first guest. And before we introduce her, I'll briefly introduce myself. I'm Bria Burton, and I am also a science fiction author. I write inspirational as well, and it's my privilege to be here with you this morning. So, I'm going to say hi to Big Ed and thank him for all that he's doing in the studio. We're going to start off right before we start talking to our first guest. We're going to play a science fiction book buzz, which is a 2-minute review that I had the pleasure of doing back in December of 2022. You may have heard this on air. Go ahead, Big Ed, when you're ready.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2022 Goodreads Choice nominee, The Mother Code by Carol Stivers, with stellar narration by Sonila Nankani. The 2020 release is available in print, ebook, and audiobook. Now, let's download the book buzz. A virus decimates populations all over the world, and a team of U.S. military tech experts execute a plan to save humankind from extinction. Their solution involves genetically altered embryos immune to the virus and artificially intelligent mothers who can carry and deliver the babies. In the event of human extinction, these mothers must be programmed to raise the only hope for the future. A colonel's fateful misstep changes the course of humanity, and the dual timeline fast-forwards to a harsh desert region where a robot mother called Rosie raises a child who knows no mother but her. As the past and future collide, a new set of challenges emerge, a battle for human survival and the unexplored bond between a child and his AI mother. This thought-provoking and richly scientific debut novel grapples with questions of motherhood while exploring human survival in a post-pandemic world, creating a cathartic experience for readers. Author Carol Stivers received her PhD in biochemistry from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and went on to postdoctoral work at Stanford University before launching a career in medical diagnostics. Her combined love of writing and her fascination with the possibilities of science brought to life her first novel. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
Okay, we got to hear a little bit about the book, and now do we have Carol Stivers on the line? Carol, hello.
Hello.
Hi, it is such a pleasure to speak with you. I'm in the studio holding up your book right now as we live on Facebook and YouTube so that those watching can take a look at this beautiful cover, The Mother Code. And it's such a pleasure to have you with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. It was great to hear from you.
And the first question that I just wanted to ask you is, you have a scientific background. How did you get into writing?
You know, one question people always ask me is, how long have I been a writer? And I find that a little difficult to answer. Even in grade school, a friend of mine and I used to like to write funny little stories and illustrate them and turn them into books. And when I was in my teenage years, I wrote a very angsty and embarrassing journal. Mm-hmm. I took poetry classes in college. And even when I was getting my PhD, I took some creative writing classes. So I think writing was always kind of lurking in the background, but it was never anything that I thought I was any good at.
Hmm.
And then when I graduated, I launched a career, and then I had to, you know, strictly writing technical jargon, you know, research papers and standard operating procedures and the like. But in 2004, I think I had the idea, I had the first glimmerings of an idea for the thing that would later become the Mother Code. It was a full 7 years later, 2011, when I had started consulting and left my last full-time job, and I had some little more time on my hands. I started having the idea of buckling down and writing the novel itself, and that's when I started taking more classes, getting more serious. I went to writer's retreats and writer's conferences and things like that, and I remember sitting in a class, and one of the instructors says, if you're sitting here, you're a writer. And I thought, So that's the first time I thought of myself as a writer, but I personally never thought of myself as a writer until I was looking for an agent and looking for a publisher, things like that. But, you know, I guess I've been, you know, a quote-unquote writer for about the last dozen years. I didn't come to it until I was in my late 50s.
Okay, wonderful. And this is your debut novel. What was that experience like of, okay, you've heard someone tell you you're a writer, okay, you're doing this thing, and then you must have gone through the process, like you said, of finding an agent and getting that first book published. Can you speak a little bit about having a first book put out there?
Well, see, the way that I found my agent, I had a developmental editor that I was working with that I had met at one of the writer's retreats, and she really believed in it, and she had experience in New York and the publishing world, et cetera. And she was the one who helped me find an agent. And to tell you the truth, I was just gobsmacked the whole process. Uh-huh. I really never thought that I thought if anything, I would self-publish or maybe not publish at all. I just didn't have very high hopes. But then, you know, I find an agent and she's just in love with the book. And then I find, she helps me find a publisher, and to me it was kind of a whirlwind experience, and everything that happened in retrospect was like a total shock and surprise. I never really, in a way that's good, right? Because
sure,
I had no expectations going
surprise.
In, right? Right, I didn't have these kind of things, these expectations that you have if you're a serious writer, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Just felt like it was all just this kind of whirlwind thing. I think the thing that was worst for me was launching a book during the pandemic.
Yes.
It was supposed to launch in May 2020, and they pushed it back to August 2020, thinking, oh, well, you know, the pandemic will be over by then. Of course, it wasn't.
Well, it's an interesting kind of coordinated thing with your book as well, that there is a pandemic in the book. Can you speak a little bit to that? I mean, obviously you wrote the book before 2020. You were talking about all the way back in 2004, the first seeds of the idea started. And then 2020 happens. How did that, as an author writing something, science fiction authors often are attempting to predict what's coming, right, and what technology is leading toward, or what certain even natural things that are happening. How did that impact you with what was happening in the real world?
Well, so I actually conceived of the idea as a cautionary tale having to do with biowarfare. And the thing in my book is not a virus. It's a biowarfare agent, which is a purified DNA. And the reason for that was because I knew that if it was a virus, it was unlikely that it would kill everybody on Earth. I needed to figure out a way to kill everybody. And something that we would no way be able to mount an immune response to.
Okay.
And it had to be something that was created with, you know, the intent of killing enemies, but it winds up killing everyone. And I really conceived of it that way. So when the pandemic happened and people started comparing my book to the pandemic, I kind of was really upset about that, actually. It wasn't, and some people even thought, you know, they had the thought that I had written it just, you know, since the pandemic started, which is impossible, you know,
right.
Because
yes.
It takes 18 months, you know,
yes.
Between acquisition to even get published. And so I finished it in about 2018, never saw any of this coming, and, you know, you kind of hope that something like this would never happen. So it's kind of really nightmarish experience, I think. A lot of readers did not resonate with the book at all because they didn't want to read about this sort of thing.
I'll share my personal experience with when I picked up the book. I believe it was sometime near the end of 2022, and I was in a similar, I had been reading a lot of more escapist in the sense of very lighthearted science fiction and fantasy. And so when I came to your book, I just thought, ooh, I loved, and I do want to talk about the artificial intelligence aspect. I loved kind of the premise of what it was talking about, and I thought, it does say on the back of the cover that there's like a pandemic happening in the book. But to your point, the difference, it's not the same as what we actually walked through, but I do relate to that sensitivity of, I don't know that I want to read about something that even resembles what you know is happening in our world. But then by 2022, when I saw your book, and I hadn't heard of it prior to that, and I just thought, I think I'm ready to read something like this. And I was so glad I picked it up, because you're right, it doesn't have the same kind of feel as what real experience would have been through worldwide, what most people may have experienced. It's much, there is this, you know, the word mother is a great loaded word, because there is just this incredible depth of just having the reader sink in to this idea of these artificially intelligent mothers. How are they going to raise? So it just goes on a totally different direction than anything that may have happened in our world at the time. So I just fell in love with the book. And can you talk a little bit about that seed, that idea with the mothers and the idea of a mother who is not human raising children, and how that became what ended up in the book?
Well, I guess it goes to how I first got the idea to write it, I guess. We were on a vacation. We were driving through the desert between Boise, Idaho, and Reno, Nevada, and you go through this corner of Oregon that's like totally desolate.
And then I'm originally from side, Oregon. I do know what you're talking about.
Oh yeah, it's the east of the Cascades. We're in the rain shadow there. But anyways, I'll tell you later. But a friend of mine who's a trout fisherman, he says, oh no, there's lots of good trout fishing over there. But other than that, I looked off to the side of the road and I see this blue pickup truck in the ditch. Its nose is buried in the dirt. And I got to wondering how long it had been there. You know, I was just sitting there, the passenger in this car, and I was daydreaming about people lost in the desert. How long would they be lost before somebody, because we didn't see anybody else on the road. And then for some reason I got to thinking, what if this was a child in there, and what if they had to fend for themselves? And and back then my daughter and her friends were watching these Japanese mecha anime shows, and I loved the Pacific Rim movies. And in those things, an operator will meld minds with a super soldier or robot, so you have this idea of a kind of mind melding between a human and an AI. And that gave me the idea for these robots who could serve as mothers to these lost children. So I also, you know, was intrigued at that time. I don't know if this is answering your question, but I was intrigued at that time with the idea of a human machine interface between the child and his bot. And I had read a book called The Future of the Mind by Michio Kaku, and it talked about that, you know, early versions of that. There's a lot more versions of that coming out every day. So that's where kind of the core ideas for the AI bringing up a child came from, I guess. That answers your question.
Yes, absolutely it does. Yes, that wonderful image of being out in the desert, because that is a big portion of the book. You have these wonderful dueling timelines as well, where we fast forward in the story to where the world predominantly has been wiped out, but there are these children surviving in the desert with their robot mothers. But then it backtracks. We go back to the before, where we see what's happening in the military. We see the decisions that are being made. And I thought, what a neat way to approach this. How did you decide to tell the story in that way?
Well, yeah, I started out, like I said, with that image of a child in the desert, and I started writing a book that was all about that. And mm-hmm. I just thought, I don't know, I'm just not resonating with this. I wanted to know how he got there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then I wanted to know, like, what happened later, right? And I felt like there had to be antagonists in a way. Mm-hmm. And could the antagonists be the same people who created him? And that's kind of how I got to where I got. And then I started writing this very windy, you know, back and forth type of narrative. The editor at Berkeley actually asked me to focus a little more on the adults in the beginning, because even the original version of the book had chapter 5 was the first chapter, and that's the chapter that opens with I in the desert. But they said, could you start with the adults, get us up a little bit, and then go to Kai in the desert? So that's the ordering of it got shuffled around a little bit.
Okay.
In the late stages. But and then when I got to the middle, I thought, okay, now I'm to the point where I can start writing forward, because now all the characters are on the same page. So that's how that came out that way. I mean,
yes,
very windy.
And a little bit organically, in the sense, like you described, writing the later portion first and then realizing, huh, how can I get a better hook for the reader to be more invested in what's happening here? And that, as a writer myself, that is often something I'm thinking of, is, okay, am I keeping the reader's attention? Am I keeping them engrossed to turn the pages? And I will say, I also listened to your book as an audiobook. Have you? So I had the privilege of being here at Joy on Paper as a guest host back in September, and one of the guests, her name is Nancy Kress, and I shared I shared with her. I listened to her audiobook of The 11th Gate, and I said to her, "What did you think?" And she goes, "I never listened to my own audiobooks." And I said, "Oh, okay, that's fascinating. I listened. It was fabulous." So my question for you is, first of all, did you listen to the audiobook? And if so, what did you think?
Okay, so I did not.
May be a trend.
Yeah, when audiobooks come out, I don't know if it's normal, but I think it's usual practice. They asked me they gave me some choices and some voice little samples to listen to. Uh-huh. And I listened, and I decided that this was the voice I would like. Two of them were men and two of them were women. And I thought, okay, I think it's got to be a woman, because Rose is such a recurring character throughout the book, both as a person and as an AI. And I felt like that particular Sunil Nankani had that kind of voice that I liked for Rose.
Yes.
And that's why I chose her. And I have to say, I have listened to a couple pages.
Okay.
But I don't know, for some reason I found it super embarrassing to listen to.
Well, you're clearly not alone. Author Nancy Kress must feel the same way, because she said the same exact thing, that she had not listened. But I, as a person who has listened, I can tell you, you're right, your narrator did an incredible job of capturing the voice, and she just had this wonderful warmth in the way she spoke that just resonated with the themes of the novel, and I just thought it was fantastic.
Maybe someday I'll listen.
maybe have somebody else listen and tell you, you know, okay, should I jump in yet?
Yeah.
Now, this book was a Goodreads Choice nominee. Did you hear about that as it was happening? Did you hear about it later? How did you find out about that?
Oh, yeah. So actually, when you are a nominee, they contact you.
They do. Oh, wonderful.
And,
yes.
Yeah. And that was in 2020. And they and it was actually a really nice, pleasant surprise. And they and in the science fiction category, because Berkeley chose to launch it as a thriller, suspense, or something like that. And so I love that it was nominated in science fiction.
Yes.
The people over there, they really liked it, and so they gave me the opportunity to write notes, which not every author gets to do. So I got to write some notes
In the Goodreads. Yeah, yeah. Oh, that is so neat. Oh, what
things
a special
like
thing. Okay, yeah, and talk a little bit about that. So the book was released as a thriller. When I picked it up, I believe I found it through BookBub, where an email comes to me daily with the types of genres I like, and I'm pretty sure they listed it under science fiction. Was that something the editors, or did you have any say in how it was released in the genre?
Well, so there's a lot of discussion when they first acquired the book, whether they were going to release it under their Berkeley imprint or under their ACE imprint, which is ACE is more science fiction, right?
Mm, okay,
and
yeah.
So, and Cindy Wang, who acquired it, she acquires books for both. But then the discussion went that, oh, well, we don't want to miss out on non-science fiction readers, women who might enjoy reading this.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to launch it through Berkeley. And then when they first came out with it, the flap copy did not mention this non-viral agent. It did not mention biowarfare. It did not mention scientists. So they were trying to make it more general interest. And so what happened was there was a little bit of a blowback amongst readers, like, oh, I picked this up and I thought it was about this, but it's about that. And there's a lot of science in it.
Yes, it is. It's very much a hard science fiction.
Yes.
As I read it, that is what I took away in the best sense of the word. Yeah.
Right. So they pivoted a little. They changed the copy that went on to Amazon, for example. They changed the flap copy that was on the paperback versus the hardback, copy.
Mm-hmm.
And so they and now they're admitting that it's science fiction.
Isn't that incredible? Yeah, even just that evolution that your book has gone through is so neat. And tell us a little bit about your website. So you have a website where people can find you, and it's your name, correct? Carol Stivers?
Yeah, carolstivers.com. You can buy the book on there. If you buy the book on there, you can read the story of where your money will go. What I'm doing there is I'm selling my complimentary author copies that I got both from the UK and from the United States, and the proceeds go to kids living in RVs here in my community.
Oh, that is wonderful. Oh, thank you for sharing that with the listeners. Yeah, so go to Carol Stivers, Carol with an E at the end, carolstivers.com, and buy your book right from her website to support this great cause. And are you currently working on anything else before we say farewell?
Oh, gosh. Right now, I'm really struggling with a completely new novel.
So
in this one, I wanted to delve more into the mystery of the human brain, something I started researching while I was working on the Mother Code. And I also wanted to write about something about the evolution of the mind. And then also, with all the excitement about space travel and UFOs, I guess they call them UAPs, right? I wanted to write something involving first contact with extraterrestrials.
Oh, so you've got your work cut out for you to take all those big themes. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. You know, and I started writing this new one in 2019, and I thought with the COVID pandemic and all and the shutdown, I would just be able to pound it out. But as usual for me, it's taking forever. So we'll see. We'll see when I finally manage to come out with this one.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, The Mother Code, I'm holding it up one more time for the listeners and those watching on YouTube and Facebook. The Mother Code by Carol Stivers. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you, Carol.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great rest of your day. Okay, so Big Ed, are we going to commercials next? All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll be back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, it's me, but I'm not Patsy. I'm Bria, filling in for Joy on Paper. And we have just had a wonderful interview with author Carol Stivers. Next, we've got our second guest for the afternoon. And before we bring him in, I've got a book buzz, a science fiction book buzz that I had the privilege of doing for his book. And we're going to listen to that, and then you'll get to meet the author and hear all more about the book. And Big Ed, go for it.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2022 series starter, Mickey 7 by Edward Ashton. The novel is available in print, ebook, and audiobook, with stellar narration by John Pirala. Soon to be a major motion picture called Mickey 17, starring Robert Pattinson.
Now, let's download the book buzz.
Every time Mickey dies, his body is remade and his uploaded conscience is downloaded into the next iteration, currently Mickey 7. As the ship's expendable, all life-threatening tasks get assigned to him. Multiples are forbidden. When he survives a fall into an icy crevasse thanks to the alien worm that carries him to safety, a shipmate had already reported him dead. Back in his room, Mickey 7 encounters Mickey 8, fresh out of the tank. Neither wants to dive back into the recycler, but can they pull off living as multiples? How hard can it be? Maybe it will make life easier for both of them. That is, until the daily rations get cut in half and Mickey's girlfriend starts to suspect something. A darkly humorous romp full of existential queries about the meaning of life, death, cloning, and immortality, Mickey 7 launches readers into a new page-turning sci-fi series with a sequel on the way. Author Edward Ashton has two other novels and over two dozen short fiction pieces published. He writes in a cabin in the woods in upstate New York. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
That's a little bit about the book. And do we have Edward Ashton here on the radio? Edward, can you hear me?
I can, and I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, it is a pleasure. I am so glad that you could join us today. And I am very excited to talk about your book. So we're going to get right into it. Mickey 7, tell us a little bit about the idea. What prompted you to take a character and kill him over and over and over?
I mean, that's an easy one. I'm an author, and there aren't
sadists. Yep.
So, they always tell you in a creative writing class, first thing they say is you come up with a character, and then you find out how you're going to get him into trouble. This was the worst sort of trouble I could come up with. So that's sort of where I wound up with the concept for the Expendables.
Yes, and the expendable. So that is Mickey, that's his position on board this spaceship, and they are going out to deep space to essentially tell us a little bit about the idea that, okay, Earth is now virtually uninhabitable. It sounds like in the book there's still maybe some people there, but for the most part, there's this diaspora going out into the galaxy. And does each ship have an expendable, or is it just the ship that Mickey's on?
The expendable is in this universe is a recent invention. Mm-hmm. The original colony missions did not have them.
Okay.
More recent ones do. Ordinarily, the expendable is a convict or someone who's been forced into the job. Mickey is very unique in that he actually volunteered for the job.
Yes, there is this wonderful scene where the recruiter is basically trying to talk Mickey out of it and say, like, dude, you really don't want this job. And that's one of the things I loved about your book. It has a lot of this wonderfully dark humor. Tell me a little bit about how did you go about sprinkling those moments in? Did it come very organically, or did you work really hard to try to get those little humorous bits throughout?
I actually worked really hard to tone it down. I'm naturally just a very sarcastic person. And so if you look at a first draft of any of my books, there's tons of dialogue where people are going back and forth and bantering, and sometimes that sort of banter occurs in places that are emotionally inappropriate. So one of the first editing path process is very regimented, because I'm an engineer. I like to do things by process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And one of the processing passes is to go through and look for places where people are being smartasses and they shouldn't, where it's completely inappropriate for them to do it. And so I would say there's probably only 20% as much snark left in the book as there was in the first draft.
That's a great word, the snark. Yes, that's a good word. That well describes a lot of the humor throughout. And I just wanted to share with you, I thought you had a wonderful opening line. This is something, as writers, if there's any writers out there listening, that opening line, that opening paragraph can be so elusive to try to get that really, the one that really hooks the reader. And your opening line in this book, I thought, was a beautiful hook. And it says, "This is going to be my stupidest death ever." And it was, the snark is there, the intrigue. Okay, so this character has multiple deaths. What does that mean? And you get into it and you see just where Mickey has gotten himself into. And I just thought, oh, what a great first line. And you talk about your process. Was the first line something that was with you at the beginning, or did that develop later as you were editing the book?
That specific line, "This is going to be my stupidest death ever," in the first draft, was actually about two paragraphs down. And I was workshopping the book with a group of other authors that train manuscripts with, and I have to give credit to my friend Craig Delancey. He saw that, and he said, "You've got to move that up to the top. That's got to be your first line." And he was, I actually fought him on it a little bit in the discussion, but he was absolutely right.
Oh my goodness, what a wonderful writing friend who could give you that insight. And Speaking of critique groups, this is something that writers here at Joy on Paper, I know the host Patsy is often talking to writers about the need for other people to get their eyes on your work to help you develop and strengthen your craft. How did you find your writing partners and the people that take a look at your work? And I take it you return the favor and take a look at theirs as well.
Yeah, I've got, again, two different groups of people who do my first reading. The first are basically family and friends. They don't have any particular expertise as writers or anything else, but they can tell me if I've gone off the rails on something, which I find really valuable. Once it's gotten through their filters, I have a group of other writers that I've connected with here in the Western New York area. I actually hooked up with them because one of them heard one of my stories on a podcast called Escape Pod, and he reached out to me and said, "Hey, I really like your work. We have this group. We meet once a month, and we exchange manuscripts and talk about our work, and we'd really like you to join." And that was, I guess, 7 or 8 years ago, and I've been meeting with them ever since, and we've gotten to be really good friends, and they've been immensely helpful to my work.
Oh, that's so wonderful. What a great man. I don't know how many writers get people reaching out saying, "I heard your work on a podcast and I want you in my group." That's what a neat thing to have happen. And I am familiar with Escape Pod. It's one of the science fiction branches of the Podcastle, Escape Pod, and Pseudopod are the three escape artists, as far as I'm remembering. And they do these wonderful podcasts with fiction stories. And so you had your story produced by one of those podcasts. I bet that was very neat to hear someone reading your story on a podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a number of stories on podcasts of one sort or another. I've had two with Escape Pod. They also have a fourth one, which is Cat's Cast, which is all cat-related stories. I haven't submitted anything to them yet. I'm not really into the cat fiction.
Oh, genre, yes, so. Interesting. They have an exclusive cat podcast. That's hilarious.
They do, yeah. It actually started as an April Fool's joke. That they were launching this cast, and they actually had a commissioned story that they read for it, and people liked it so much that they made it an actual part of their lineup. So.
You know, there really is a place for every writer. If you're writing cat stories, I hope you're listening, and now you know where you can submit your stories
Absolutely.
About cats. So tell us a little bit about this book. Is the first book in a series that you're writing, correct?
That's a bit of a difficult question. It wasn't sold to my publisher as a series.
Ah.
It was sold as a standalone book. But I always try to leave a little opening at the end of everything that I write to build more. Because the way that the publishers look at things is that they assume that in a series, the sales of each subsequent book will be a fraction of the sales of the previous book. So if you go to them and pitch up four-book series, and the first book doesn't do as well as they expected, or even if it does reasonably well, but just not outstandingly, they're likely to cut that series short.
Okay.
And I never wanted to leave my readers hanging with an unfinished story. So every one of my books is a standalone story, but they are sometimes connected. And lead one to the next. So right now, Antimatter Blues is a sequel to Mickey 7. That's the second book in the series, if you want to call it that. Again, if you finish that book, you'll see I've left myself an opening. I've completed the story. It's completely wrapped up, but there is a possibility that more could be done here. And whether more is going to be done here or not, it's going to depend on what my publisher, my editors think about how that book performs.
As you say that, it resonates very much with me, having read the book. It is a very complete story. You get the full arc of this character as he discovers what it means when he meets his clone and decides, I don't want to go in the recycler. And it's such a funny moment, and I don't want to spoil it, but there are just these wonderful little antics that happen throughout the book. And by the end, yeah, there is that complete story, and we see where the character is growing and learning through this process. And the world building that you have, I just thought you did such an incredible job. Can you just expand a little bit on decisions that you made for what made it into the novel, and maybe what did you write that you thought, well, I as the author need to know all these things about this universe that I've created, but only a little bit can get in the novel. Do you know what I'm referring to in that idea of when you're world building, not everything gets in the novel, but it's something that might show up in a later book?
Yeah, absolutely. And world building is a unique part of science fiction and fantasy writing. You know, if you write a book that's set in contemporary Manhattan, you don't need to do world building. You just mention, the site of the Empire State Building, and everyone knows exactly where you are and exactly what the setting is and what the sort of rules and the mores are of the culture. When you're writing something that's set 1,000 years in the past or 1,000 years in the future, you can't do that. You have to actually paint a picture for the reader of what the world is, what things look like, how technology works now, how people interact now, probably social mores and customs are different. And you can't just lay that out. You can't just start with, you know, a chapter where you describe everything about how the world works. That's an info dump, and nobody wants to read that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you have to find ways to sort of subtly work into the manuscript clues to the reader to pick up on how things work here and what's going on. And the way that I did that in this book was I made my protagonist a historian, and I had him sort of obsess over various aspects of his culture's history, and in that way I'm able to present him to the reader, hopefully in an entertaining way.
Oh, very much so. And that, what a neat choice to have him be this history buff who is very interested in where humanity came before his time, so that when he's thinking about those things, it makes sense to the story. It doesn't feel like the author is intruding and just throwing all this info at the reader that they don't actually need to move the story forward. I thought you did that beautifully. And talk a little bit about, for example, his good buddy, who they have this, so his friend Berto, they have this very interesting relationship where they're friends, but there's almost this antagonistic element to their friendship, especially at the beginning when we do find out Berto is responsible for part of Mickey's problems, which leads to this Mickey 8 coming up out of the tank before Mickey 7 actually is dead, and the whole idea of cloning and all that. So Berto, that character, at one point is doing, he's this very kind of macho man, and he does this sporting competition. How did you come up with the sporting competition that he did, and that ends up being a little bit of a flashback, but it's so effective?
Yeah, I based the character of Berto loosely on someone that I actually knew when I was younger, and I'm still friends with. And I've mentioned to him that he was the basis of this character. I don't know that he's particularly happy with me about that.
So no.
I'd probably send out an apology to him now if he's listening. But there are some people who just are good at everything they try. You meet these people occasionally, and he's one of them.
Yes.
You know, this is a guy who, the real life person is someone who just decided he wanted to try out for a Division I basketball team in college and made the team.
Oh, yeah.
you shouldn't be able to do that. That's not something that a human should be able to do, but he's able to do these things. And that sort of person can be great to hang around with and also can be really annoying to hang around with. And I tried to capture that sort of dynamic. And there's also a little bit of a big brother, little brother relationship between Berto and Mickey, particularly at the beginning of the book, that I wanted to play off of as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. And just to go back to modeling characters on real people. So often, writers who, for example, might use a pen name, or they don't want their family to know they're writing these books because, oh, I don't know, the family member might look and say, is that supposed to be me? I love that you just went ahead and told your friend, okay, this character is based on you, and then had to kind of deal with the repercussions of that, because as we create characters, as authors, the you know, real life examples that are modeled for us by having relationships with people, that tends to make a story richer. And I think your example that you just gave was such a wonderful example of, here is a type of person, and it's not even that your friend is entirely this Berto character, but that type of person who can just go pick up a basketball and suddenly they're the star player, even though they didn't grow up playing, that type of thing. And that's something people can look at and say, oh, I know somebody like that. And so much of your story, I thought, had all those little relatable elements to characters and excellent job with those characterizations. So let's go back to the cloning. Tell us a little bit about the cloning and what is it that that gave you the idea that, okay, this expendable is going to be the only one who gets to be cloned, but he's not allowed to have multiples. You set these rules, which is a wonderful thing to do in a story, to set these rules that shouldn't be broken, and then you go ahead and break them, and that's really the impetus for the story. Can you talk a little bit about the idea of the cloning and where all that it came from and where you wanted it to go?
Well, the idea of the cloning actually is something that's been a little bit of an obsession of mine ever since I was young.
Mm-hmm.
And it really comes back to a philosophical problem that goes back to the 1700s, which is called the teletransport paradox. It was originally formulated as a letter to the English Royal Society, where the question was, if I could copy, at that time they were talking about souls, if I could copy my soul into a new body that was exactly like mine in every way, would that person be me, or would this be a new person? And so the place where you've seen that in modern culture is the transporter beam in Star Trek. Right? So you step on the transporter beam, and it sort of scans the position of every atom in your body or whatever it does and transmits the information someplace else, and then they rebuild you on the other end. And the question is, has that person been transported? Or has that person been killed? And just a new person who thinks he's him and looks like him and acts like him is now running around on this other planet. And this is an idea that other writers have played around with.
Yes.
There's a very famous story called Think Like a Dinosaur, for instance, that hits this topic much more sort of like nail on the head. But that's a question that I have thought about a lot in different ways, and I've explored it in some of my short fiction as well as, you know, obviously looking at it in Mickey 7, and honestly, I still don't know where I land on it.
Would I get onto that
transporter pad or not? Yeah. I don't know.
It's quite a dilemma to think, if this means I'm about to be killed, but then I'll wake up thinking I haven't been. Yeah, quite a dilemma if that were a reality, that a choice we had to make. And you talk about the ship of Theseus in the book.
Yeah, I mean, that's a much older philosophical question. That goes back to Plutarch. That's one that's also been explored in various places. But the basic idea there is that you have a ship, it's sailing around the world, and as it sails, it gets damaged, it loses individual boards, spars, lines, they all have to be replaced. By the time it gets back, every single piece of the ship has been replaced, and is it the same ship?
Right.
And as it turns out, this is a really tight analogy for human life, because, you know, you and I sitting here, there's not a single cell in our bodies that was part of our bodies 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We've been complete with this sort of colony organism that is us, this group of cells, is made up of completely different individual cells than it was 15 years ago.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful philosophical questions that science fiction, oh, is just so rife with. This is one of the reasons I love reading it. And the big news that I could not wait to ask you about, there is a film coming called Mickey 17 featuring, I believe, Robert Pattinson has been cast as the lead. Is that correct?
Yep. Mark Ruffalo, going to be it. Naomi Aki.
Oh, my goodness.
Holiday Granger. It's a really nice cast.
What an exciting development. And what is the name change? So your book, Mickey 7, as a film, is going to be called Mickey 17. Do you have any kind of input when they take your book and say, we want to make it a movie? Or is it, we are now in charge and you have no say in any of this? Tell us a little bit about that.
Once they option your book, you really don't have any say in what they do with it. They bought rights. They can do pretty much anything they want. Now, in this particular case, the director is Bong Joon-ho, who is an absolutely wonderful person, and I've gotten the opportunity to speak with him a number of times now. And when he first got involved with the project, he called me, and we spoke for about 2 hours. And just talked about different aspects of the book. He asked me a bunch of questions about, like, how do creepers reproduce?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's when a mommy creeper and a daddy creeper love each other very much, I guess. I don't know. but he actually asked me if there was something in the book that I felt needed to be in the movie. Because when you go from a book to a movie, you lose things necessarily. You're going from a 350-page novel to a 120-page script, and things are going to have to come out. And he said, I want you to tell me the one thing that you feel is the heart of this book, and I will promise you that it will be in the film. And he didn't have to do that by any stretch, but he did it. And so I said,
wow, that's so neat.
I had to think
neat.
About it for about 2 seconds, and I said, chapter 19, I want chapter 19 to be in the film. And he said, oh, that's fantastic. That actually, I cried when I read that chapter. I was going to put that in there anyway. And I said, can I get another one? And he said, no.
It didn't hurt to ask, though, right?
It never hurts to try. Never hurts to try. But the point is, he didn't have to do that. He made that allowance for me, and I really appreciate it, and I'm very, very grateful.
Well, what an incredible thing. You got 2 hours to just talk to this director who's going to be taking your book and turn it into film. And did he tell you why he named it Mickey 17?
He just liked murder. He didn't feel like I was murderous enough, and he wanted to murder some more.
Okay, so just to give the Mickey 7 is actually the 7th Mickey. So we've got Mickey 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and in the story we start with Mickey 7. So he wants there to be a lot more Mickeys before...
Yeah.
Okay, so it's just a matter of a lot more deaths are going to be happening. Well, we do have to wrap up, but this has been absolutely wonderful to talk to you. I'm looking at the Ed Fort right now, your website, and tell us, it is edwardashton.com is where people can find you and learn more about your books and where to buy them.
That's it. All the buy links are there, all my short stories, pretty much everything you'd want to know about me.
Wonderful. Edwardashton.com. And you can even see a preview of Antimatter Blues, a Mickey 7 novel. When does that release?
That comes out in March, March 23rd in the U.S., I believe.
Wonderful. Go ahead and get your copy, listener, of Mickey 7 so that when the sequel comes, you'll be ready. And it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you, Edward.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye now. And this is Bria Burton. If you want to know more about me, go to my website, briaburton.com, and you can find out all about my writing and what's going on. Thank you, listeners, and go out there and get writing.